You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
With the war in Ukraine dominating the headlines, you'd be forgiven for not keeping up with what's happening in US news lately. This morning, I caught up with Dr. Maria Amudian from the University of Auckland to talk about current affairs in the United States. Firstly, Judge Ketanji Brown Jackson has been nominated to the Supreme Court by Joe Biden. Why would her appointment be so historic?
Well, obviously, he has made it a point to say he is going to appoint the first black woman to the U.S. Supreme Court to be a justice there. It's interesting, too, she would be the first black woman to serve. And really, we've only had a handful of women serve over the long period of time on the Supreme Court. So even that is still pretty historic, with Sandra Day O'Connor being the first. And that was, you know, not that long ago. But I think the other really interesting part about Ketanji Brown Jackson is her really diverse background and experience. So like a lot of the other justices, she's Ivy League educated and is super bright in those terms and clerked for Supreme Court justice, the one she's replacing, actually. But the other parts of her career, her non-judging, because she has been a judge for quite a while, her non-judgeships and her clerkships have been in criminal defense, and particularly in the public defender's office. That's something we haven't seen before, and that's a perspective that has long been missing from the Supreme Court. You've got a lot of people who've had some variation in their life experiences, but not shoulder to shoulder with the people who do not have the funds to pay for a lawyer. And she's been that public defender, and that's what they do. So that's a whole other area that's been long missing from the Supreme Court. And I think that's really historic, too.
And with this nomination process, she's currently facing questioning from Republicans on a judicial committee. So far, they've accused Judge Jackson of being partisan and soft on crime, yes. I assume due to her background as a public defender. How valid are these concerns?
I don't think they're valid at all. I mean, I think when you look at it across the spectrum, she's really in the, all of her decisions have been in the same range as something like 70 to 80% of all other judges in terms of her sentencing. So it's not that far away, and she's gotten endorsed by law enforcement. If she was really soft on crime, would the law enforcement be endorsing her? Really unlikely. So I think that, you know, there's such a kind of mean-spiritedness between some Democrats and some Republicans at this point, where they just kind of want to show up the other side. And these judicial hearings, you know, they used to not happen. It's a recent phenomenon, especially when television started. It's a way for these senators to grandstand and to be visible to their constituents in a way, and to show their constituents, you know, how great they are in the areas that they think the constituents care about. So this is a relatively new phenomenon over the last few decades. It's become more and more contentious as polarization has gone on. It was rarely this ugly before. I think probably the Democrats started it with Judge Bork. There's this new term called borking somebody, which means derailing a justice's nomination.
Yeah, it seems to be more almost like an exhibition playing to an audience rather than for actual justice.
Yes, so. Yes, I think that's absolutely right. I think it's playing to a couple of audiences.
On the topic of polarization, several conservative states are looking to introduce very restrictive abortion laws, including the death penalty for people getting an abortion. Does this represent the increasing political divide and kind of the end of the separation of church and state?
Well, I would say it's absolutely reflective of the political divide. For a very long time, the religious right, really, more than the religious left, has been one issue voters on abortion. Like, they really do think that life begins at conception, and that all of those lives, even when they're just you know, a mass of cells are to be protected. Some people joke and say until they are born, but nonetheless, they have been fighting against the decision of Roe versus Wade in all kinds of ways and kept doing these test cases, like passing these increasingly restrictive laws around abortion. And until you had this conservative majority, really strong, you know, anti-abortion majority on the Supreme Court, there was no chance of overturning Roe versus Wade. But what's happened is these states are coming up with other ways of enforcing the anti-abortion laws, and Texas is kind of the model in which what they have proposed is making abortion illegal after 6 weeks, which most people know is really early to find out if you're pregnant or not. But the other thing is, instead of it being a state that enforces the law, they're empowering citizens to file a lawsuit against anybody that helps a woman get an abortion beyond the 6 weeks. So that could probably be, you know, I've heard some people say it could be an Uber driver. It could be somebody giving advice. And so it becomes pretty draconian in that way. Could tie up the courts for a very long time on these things. But what that does is it kind of gets around the state enforcement, the parts that the Supreme Court normally would rule on, because the Constitution is a document that deals with government itself.
Joe Biden has recently released a new budget plan where anyone making over $100 million a year will now be taxed at a higher rate. How effective will this be in reducing this inequality in the states?
Well, I think it will help a little bit. I think the more important thing, well, first of all, whether or not it'll pass, right? So these are, you know, the United States has a whole process of legislation that means that a president cannot do it all by himself. So we'll see if that gets anywhere and if it becomes an enforceable law. But in essence, I think it will go some way if it passes, in that it provides money that is now not in the budget to give people a little bit of a stepping stone to, you know, not being in poverty. And so that's kind of the big place where it helps. Mm. The other thing that it addresses, because the United States doesn't have any kind of wealth tax, I mean, they've got capital gains taxes, but the way the extreme wealthy get around that is they just never sell anything so that there is no capital gain. They just keep accumulating wealth without turning it into income. And so this is supposed to get at that. And maybe it will discourage a little bit of the, you know, hoarding of, you know, wealth, whether it's in stocks and bonds or if it's in art and houses. Mm. That's the other thing it might help. I mean, people who have been buying up houses, buying up property, and so making the property market soar to such an extreme, you know, perhaps it'll get them to stop buying so many houses and allow other people to have some of that at a reasonable price, which is really difficult right now here and in the United States.
What kind of resistance do you see this tax plan facing?
Well, some of the legislators are very wealthy themselves. I don't know how many of them it will touch, but it might. Look, there's just this mantra in the United States, especially among the Republicans, of, you know, not only no taxes, but they don't like government. You know, they don't like the government involved in, you know, trying to help poor people get to the middle class, you know, with all the structural inequalities and that sort of a thing. They don't believe in that ideologically. So I think it will have some stumbling blocks. Yeah.
And finally, our last topic for today, a U.S. judge has ruled that Donald Trump likely committed a felony when he attempted to obstruct Congress after the November 2020 election, which he lost. What consequences is he likely to face?
Well, keep in mind that this judge was ruling on something else. What this was all about was the January 6th committee wanted some documents from Trump and one of his lawyers, who is a professor in California named Eastman, Professor Eastman, and they had ruled that it was protected under the attorney-client privilege. Now, normally, communication between a client and their attorney is considered off-limits, with one exception, and that exception is if there is something criminal going on, and that's what the judge was ruling on. So it wasn't like he had a case of felony in front of him. He was ruling on whether or not the January 6th committee could have those documents. So he had to say whether or not there was a potential felony, in which he said, yes, there is a potential felony. But in order to prosecute that felony, the Attorney General of the United States would have to open that. And to date, we've heard nothing from the Attorney General, Merrick Garland, about whether or not he is investigating on the high levels of the January 6th events. He's already gotten some prosecutions of some of the lower levels, people who've been involved in the actual siege at the Capitol, but he has not signaled what he's doing with the top, which is probably the right thing to do, is to not signal. So we'll see what happens there. There was another criminal investigation going on in New York for against Trump for fraud, but Cyrus Vance, who was the district attorney at the time, had termed out or stepped down, I can't remember which, and the new district attorney has decided not to pursue it. They had already convened a grand jury, and lead lawyers resigned over this ending of the investigation.
That was Dr. Maria Amudian from the University of Auckland speaking to me about the latest news from the United States.
That was a 95BFM podcast. To hear more, head to 95BFM.com/bcasts.